This is Andrew Kate.
And this is Ryan Capuano.
And welcome to another edition of the Death of Cinema podcast. In this week's episode, I finally get to talk some Nicolas Cage with Mandy, while Jeffrey Wright holds the dark for Jeremy Saulnier.
But until we get to your beloved Nick Cage, we are going to start with Jeremy Saulnier's Hold the Dark, which Andrew was fortunate enough to see back at the Toronto International Film Festival last month, and I just recently caught up with on Netflix. It is now available on Netflix. Everyone has a Netflix account. You can pretty much watch it for the cost of one movie ticket and all that other stuff that you get with Netflix. So here's the thing. I really like Jeremy Saulnier's Green Room. I was on the wavelength that he was going for with that film. I think, obviously Nazis are a really easy punching bag, but he used it very, very well and still found a way to make them scary. So here in Hold the Dark, which basically centers around Jeffrey Wright, who is a wolf expert from Anchorage, who is called up to the northern part of the state by Riley Keough, whose son is taken by wolves, or so she says. So she basically just wants him to track down the wolf and kill it because he knows that the kid's not coming back. And then Alexander Sarsgaard is the husband who's deployed in Iraq right now. And I don't know, man, this is just a really, we had two very dark movies on this podcast this week. This is really tough to get through. I want to say the movie is beautifully shot. Saulnier has a very good, I know you've mentioned in the past, he's the guy that just kind of gets that visual language of cinema, and he uses it very well. I just think that for me personally, maybe I was just not in the right mindset and I wasn't on his wavelength for this particular story and its themes, that it just, I don't know if it went over my head or if it just kind of hit me in the wrong way, but it just left me kind of cold and honestly at times a little bit bored. I mean, I guess my problem is with the Alexander Skarsgård character. I don't really want to say too much because, you know, a lot happens even within the first 30 minutes that could be considered spoiler territory. So what I'll say is that I find that there were some narrative missteps that kind of pulled the film in a different direction that maybe that confused me in a way. And I know maybe, you know, you had a much different experience with this and I'm sure it connected better for you. And maybe it's just I'm not in this same mentality that Saulnier is actually in. But Jeffrey Wright is very good in this film, as he is in everything. I honestly think he's one of the most underrated actors on the planet, if not of his entire generation. And he does carry this film through for me. And Skarsgård, I mean, he does what he does. I mean, if you've seen one performance from him, you've seen them all, but he's reliable. And James Badge Dale, who plays one of the cops who's up there, who's helping Jeffrey Wright kind of track down this kid. And then once Alexander Skarsgård comes back from Iraq, and it's just, I don't know, it's very confusing. And it's the film starts off in a very specific way, and then within like 25 minutes is already in a completely different direction. And that was jarring, and it left me trying to grasp what was actually trying to be said here. And there's something to be said for the way Saulnier directs this and from a visual standpoint. And he knows how to use violence well in his movies. I don't think anything is cheap or any gratuitous, maybe, but it fits this particular story. I do have one issue with the introduction of Alexander Skarsgård's character, where he's basically walking through the streets of Iraq and comes across one of his fellow soldiers raping an Iraqi woman, and then he basically takes that guy out and gives the knife to the Iraqi woman to finish the job. I don't know where that kind of fits in the broader scheme of the story and how that actually plays into his character, especially considering the choices he makes and the wolf mask that he wears later in the film and all this weird shit. I don't want to say it's a misstep completely for me. It just left, I was on the outside looking in with this one. I was never on the same wavelength.
Well, yeah, as Ryan mentioned, you know, I was fortunate enough to see the world premiere of this film at the Toronto International Film Festival, and obviously, like you said, it's now available for Netflix for everyone to watch. But it's funny you bring up Skarsgård, because I have a note written down here of what he talked about during the Q&A, which may inform that. And he talked about how he's the type of actor who tends to push against the arc, was his words. And essentially, what he means by that is the character arc or whatever. And I think the evidence is clearly on display in this film, where they kill it. And I definitely understand what you're saying about that interesting Iraq sequence, where it's just sort of there, and then we sort of, that's the only sequence that sort of takes place outside the typical Alaskan dark setting or whatever, which is used, I think, quite well, especially visually. But yeah, it's really interesting that they use that, because, but I think the thing that I loved so much about the film is that, you know, I've been a big fan of Jeremy Saulnier's previous work. You mentioned Green Room, and before that he made Blue Ruin, another collaboration with Macon Blair, who is not only has a small role in this, but also wrote the script of Hold the Dark, whatever, and they were there at the Q&A as well. But you alluded to the violence as well, something that I feel like Saulnier has always used well, and that's the thing. Yeah, it is gratuitous, but the thing I respect about him so much is he's clearly doing it with a purpose. He uses violence on the screen and shows the very real consequences of it, and that's something I really just enjoy on screen when violence is used not just, you know, just to throw it at the screen, but to use it to show the very real consequences. And Saulnier sort of made that clear sort of after the film and discussing it. But getting back to sort of Skarsgård's character, obviously it takes a jump from him over in Iraq to being this sort of very violent being, without getting into specific spoilers, at the home. And that's one, actually, the element I liked most about it was that it sort of combined, and I'm not saying it completely, everything works in the film, but I almost enjoyed that sort of combination of this, you know, utilizing violence, sort of, you know, Saulnier's films are never, could be classified as specifically horror films, but they use horror elements. And one of the things that was really intoxicating to me about this film was this element of this mysticism, this unexplained thing. And I think that's why I enjoyed the film so much, is that I didn't need any of that explained to me in that sense. And I'm not saying you do, because I know you enjoy really heady stuff as well or whatever, but I guess it was just one of those things where I don't know, the mysticism, some of the Indian actors I thought were really effective and sort of giving us ideas of what is going on, but not completely spelling it out. And then the ending really left me a bit, like, it didn't leave me cold. It sort of left me like, oh, that's interesting. They don't ever explain the actions of the characters, and it's almost like I view Alexander Skarsgård's character as sort of this type of, almost like a slasher villain, but not to that degree or whatever. I don't know. You can see how my thoughts are sort of jumbled, because all of this, it just sort of went together to make me experience it in this sort of, and I was just sort of like, oh, there's this mystical element that Saulnier hasn't brought into these incredibly violent films he's made in the past, and that's something that layer just sort of added to it for me. And I also really liked Jeffrey Rush. Totally different actor. But Jeffrey Wright, I really liked him in the film. I always like him. I think he's always good in pretty much everything he's in. He just has this presence. And, you know, you think this film is going to be about one thing, sort of the wolves and stuff like that. And that's sort of alluded to in the first half. And I don't know, just this one sequence where Jeffrey Wright's staring down wolves. And I was like, oh, yeah, I'm into this or whatever. But I don't know. It was just something about the film to me that I didn't get all the answers I was looking for. I don't know exactly the intention of the filmmaker, but I like that he's utilizing these elements he's used before and bringing in this new element of mysticism and just sort of leaving it up to the audience. And just for those of you that don't know, this was adapted from a book, apparently, so I don't know if that had any effect on the telling of the story and how Saulnier chose to tell this story, or whether he put so much of himself into it, or whether he just more took a hands-off approach. And that may be why people are sort of not enjoying it as much as his previous work.
Yeah, I mean, Saulnier really needs to be commended for not really giving any easy answers here, and for just kind of letting the audience interpret those final, let's say, 10 minutes or so for our own merit. And like I said, I just really wasn't on that. Like, he didn't give us any the answers we wanted, but maybe I was just asking the wrong questions. So I'm putting this onus just as much on me as I would on the filmmaker here. I just didn't click with this particular film. But I did want to touch upon the Native American element of this film that you briefly mentioned, because this is another thing that pulls the film in a completely different direction. And I don't want to get into spoiler territory, because I think on its own merit, it might actually be the best sequence in the film, where there's it's pretty violent and goes on for a long time, and I'll leave it at that. But it brings in something to the forefront that was, like, briefly alluded to and teased, but almost feels like something that was kind of left on the cutting room floor of Wind River from last year, to a certain extent. So it's just like these little things. Maybe I was just not thinking in the same way that Saulnier was, and just like kind of taking this as just one jumbled whole, as opposed to trying to see it as one streamlined thing, a jumbled whole versus a streamlined whole. And that's totally fine. I, like I said, it, this isn't, if I was bored in this, that might be more on me. I might not have been in the right frame of mind for this. Maybe I was expecting something completely different. And maybe, you know, just because I like Green Room, I was expecting something different. But as it stands, it's not a film that I can really knock, even if I disliked it. I encourage you to seek it out yourself if you have the stomach for it, because it is pretty gooey. Maybe not as much as our second film, which we'll be getting to momentarily. But it's interesting. If you're a fan of anyone in the cast, give it a shot, but just prepare to be left with more questions than answers, even if you did like the film.
Yeah, definitely. And as I sort of alluded to, it's definitely a film with its flaws. But sometimes for me, it's really just about, and obviously being at the film festival, you're sort of this mindset where you're just looking for these unique experiences or whatever. And I totally got that from that. There's really, like, sitting that as close to the screen as I was, like, in the front, pretty much the front row, seeing this and seeing all these people on. I mean, it obviously had some effect on me in some way or whatever. But you alluded to that sequence, that very violent sequence, which I won't over-explain, but safe to say, that's a set piece that really sort of, I think, really sort of harkens back to what I was talking about with Jeremy Saulnier has never shied away from violence, and he shows the very real consequences of that. And in fact, one of my favorite moments in the film is directly after that sequence, where there's this scene in a hospital where it's just this shot of this woman in a hallway, and we haven't met this woman before. We don't know a single thing about her or whatever. And it's this shot of in the hospital. You don't know exactly the context of it. And then James Badgdale enters the scene, and it just really has the impact. And for those of you who've seen the film will know exactly what I'm talking about, but that was a moment. Those are the moments in this film. There were moments that just really connected with me, I think, and that's where sort of the power of the film comes from. Like I said, you know, it doesn't make it easy. It doesn't really say, you know, this is what the film's about. There's lots of different elements to it, lots of genre elements, which obviously I'm a big horror guy in a genre of these horror elements as well, so I'm always enjoying these different elements thrown in. I guess I was just excited, like I said, to see Saulnier throw in this mystical element and have these Native American characters sort of add on to that and add sort of layers to the overall story. But yeah, overall, I really liked it. And I also did want to mention briefly, this is another film that continues the great tradition of utilizing end credit songs to punctuate a story or whatever. I don't know if they changed the song at all. I don't know. I didn't watch it again on Netflix, so I don't know. But all I can say is that I really feel like, I don't know, there's something about the ending where it's like they have this running thing, which is one of those elements that feels like, you know, it's a lesser element of the film, but it's utilized for this to have this ending and sort of have the punctuation. So I did enjoy that, and I just want to say any film that utilizes end credits songs properly, I think some films can get away with not being very good and then have an end credit song that punctuate it and just leaves you feeling a certain way. And I'm not saying this film is that case, because I really enjoyed the film overall. And I think there's obviously, you know, definitely critics. I mean, didn't seem to get as good reviews as his previous couple films do, but I really enjoyed it. I definitely recommend checking it out if you're a Saulnier fan or a fan of any of these genre type of films.
And before we close out on this film, I just want to take maybe just a couple minutes to delve into what I'd like to call James Badgdale Appreciation Day. This guy has really just been killing it nonstop over the past decade, very quietly, I might add. You know, going toe-to-toe with, he was a very small bad guy in Iron Man 3. He was that guy with cancer who was smoking in the hallway with Denzel Washington in Flight. He carried that friggin' Michael Bay Benghazi movie, which, I mean, that I won't even get into that. But this is a guy who has like this very good everyman feel to him, but he does it so well, and I feel like someday someone's gonna turn him loose and he's gonna give a performance for the ages, because I just love the guy.
Well, it's funny you mention this, because he was there or whatever, but he was there, I saw him in multiple films while I was there. He was also in this other film, Donnybrook, which he played a cop as well, but a completely, let's just say, a very different type of cop than the one he plays in this one or whatever. So it's really interesting, because I saw it like one day, and then the next day I saw his role in this, and I was like, oh, that's really interesting. But it's funny you mentioned James Badgdale, because I remember him, the first time I saw him was in my first TV obsession. Safe to say, many shows have passed it since, but he starred in 24 alongside Kiefer Sutherland in season 3 as the infamous Chase, the boyfriend character of Jack Bauer's daughter, Kim, or whatever. And I don't remember what happened. I think he was only on it for like one season or whatever, but that's always what I think of him when I think of first. But it's really encouraging to see him show off his writing. He definitely did that. He was in even more films at the festival and he was there, so he must have been running around like a chicken with his head cut off. But I thought it was really interesting that you brought that up, because he was really effective not only in this film but also in Donnybrook, another film that I was able to check out. We can transition now into our second film of the day. And obviously, as I alluded to, I've been so excited to talk about anything film starring Nick Cage. And boy, do we have a doozy for you this time or whatever. This is a film by director Panos Cosmatos, whose only previous film, I believe, is Beyond the Black Rambo or whatever. A film that's been on my list forever that I haven't gotten around to. But safe to say, Mandy is a film that has certainly found its audience or whatever. You know, it's actually been quite successful at the box office, even though it hasn't come to a theater around us. But it is out there on VOD, so it is available for people to watch. But safe to say, it's an incredibly unique film, characters by insanely striking cinematography from its first frame to its last. I thought a really great evocative score from the late, great Johan Johansson. Two great central performances, first of all, from Andrea Riseborough, I think is really effective, and just she has this quality where she's on screen and she's engaging. She doesn't have to do anything. She just has a presence on screen. And of course, you know, Nick Cage, who I will say, you know, for the first half, there definitely is some of that classic vintage crazy Cage, but I think it's a much more controlled performance from him, particularly in the second half or whatever, and I think it was effective, even with that said. But safe to say, this film, like I said, it's a very unique beast. It sort of centers on this character that plays Nick Cage and his wife Mandy, the titular Mandy, and essentially what happens is this crazy sort of religious cult take Mandy away from him, and then it's sort of a revenge. The second half of the movie is sort of a revenge with Nick Cage on the warpath, taking out these cultists or whatever. But safe to say, you know, I said insanely striking cinematography, but even that doesn't do it justice, because when you see this film, it's like its use of color, just so many striking shots that's just sort of etched yourself sort of into your brain. And I feel like if the cinematography of this film wasn't as distinct and effective, the film definitely wouldn't work as well. But combine that with the score, and you just safe to say you have a very insane, unique film that I definitely really enjoyed.
Yeah, this movie, oh, Jesus, I don't even know where to start with this. So, you know, Nick Cage does what Nick Cage does in this film, and God bless him, we're all the better for it, for having him in our lives. And, you know, you mentioned it's a more controlled performance. Maybe more controlled compared to, like, Vampire's Kiss or something like that, but it's still just him completely hamming it up when necessary. I mean, I think he's actually the best part of the film. He is able to mine, you know, basically in the second half of the film is where he is pretty put at the forefront. He kind of takes a backseat in the first half, but he just, you know, he goes crazy, but he's able to ground it in reality, which is strange considering that the film is actually shot like an acid trip, and I don't know if any of our listeners have actually done acid, but they get it pretty close. And acid is actually used as some sort of a MacGuffin later on in the film, too, which is actually kind of funny. I didn't think they were going to get that literal with it, but hey, whatever. And I want to give credit to Linus Roach. For those of you who don't know who it is, the only movie you're going to remember him from was when he played Thomas Wayne in Batman Begins. So he's on screen for, what, like 5 minutes? Yeah. So here he plays like this... I guess it's kind of loosely based off of a Charles Manson type figure, even though it's he doesn't necessarily embody that particular vibe. But you know, he has like that crappy folk song that he flips out whenever someone criticizes him. You know, he calls his victim pigs. He has this, you know, cult like followers who are all hippies. And I mean, the movie's just weird, man. There's no other way to put it. But it is hallucinatory, literally, very much so. And it's all, but it's, you know, occasionally very mesmerizing and gripping. I mean, it's slow moving and very plotting. I mean, they really wanted to mimic that feeling of being on acid. So to that end, some people might find it a little too sluggish in the beginning, and I did, I'll admit, but it wasn't really enough to really be of any detriment, because once it actually picks up and it gets into that gonzo violence, as has been heralded from here to eternity, it's really just insane. I mean, this is, you know, NC-17 level gore, and it's just so much fun to watch a director just let loose and have, and, you know, obviously, this is, all right, so I'm going to go on a little thing about violence in movies, because I just, you know, I didn't poo-poo the violence in the Hold the Dark, but there is, you know, context here. I mean, there's this type of fantasy horror violence I'm completely okay with, because it does serve as catharsis in these very dark stories, and this is a very dark story, and it ends very cathartically. I mean, there's like this mystical biker group that OD'd on acid, so now they're just like permanently changed, and they're permanently in pain, and as one character puts it, they are in love with that feeling. This is really just it's strange. strange. I don't know how else to put it. You're either with it or you're not. You either love the fact that Nick Cage is doing his Nick Cage stuff and getting into chainsaw fights with maniacal hippies, or it's really, I mean, if that sounds like it's up your alley, if that sentence doesn't make you feel one thing or another, you probably should skip it. But based on that alone, I think you'll know what you're getting into. I enjoyed myself.
Yeah, this is definitely for, I would say it's for both the art house crowd and the genre crowd, weirdly, in a weird way. I don't think all genre fans are going to be able to appreciate it on its level. As you alluded to, the first half is a very methodical build, but I think the cinematography and, like I said, the performances, just seeing Andrea Riseborough on screen, she just has this presence that I think is so haunting, and I think it's to the benefit of the film. I thought it was really interesting. There's even some animated sequences in the second half that help with Mandy's sort of presence sort of hovering over the film, and I quite liked that. I mean, I could certainly see why people wouldn't or whatever. They're almost heavy metal-esque, I guess I would say, or whatever. But I thought that was an interesting choice. But you alluded to Linus Roach's character. And I just want to say, one of my favorite scenes in the film is when he plays the music for Mandy or whatever, and she just starts laughing at him. And I thought, you know, if you really break this down, our central Jesus freak villain is really, all he is just a failed musician. And I think that's so funny that that's really his essence or whatever. And I thought that scene, I don't know, I just thought it was so effective because of it. But he was great. Just sort of the unhinged performances. People are really bringing it. And obviously when you have a film starring Nick Cage, it's only natural to go down that road. I will say, in terms of one of the flaws of the film, you know, I wouldn't say this is something I focus too heavily on, but certainly say that some of the dialogue, I would say, is a bit iffy. But it is one of these films where it's like, because the cinematography and the score and the visuals are really sort of the more important element, that the dialogue, as is often the case in a lot of genre films, sort of is a bit iffy. You know, the film starts with a line of dialogue, which I was completely baffled by, a knock-knock joke about Eric Estrada told by Nick Cage. I mean, that just about says it all or whatever. But I was like, this is so weird. And it felt like there was a couple references where, like, oh yeah, Crystal Lake is down the road, and it was sort of like, but they move on from so quickly, it was sort of like, all right, that doesn't bother me too much. But especially in the first half, there was just a couple lines where I was like, all right, buddy, you know, it probably would have been better if you just removed that line of dialogue and they didn't say a thing or whatever, because it would just sort of add to the experience. But obviously, like I said, there's some classic, you know, unhinged Nick Cage. But I, like, this is the interesting thing about Nick Cage, and I have to give my piece about Nick Cage, because people are so judgmental of Nick Cage. When you think of Nick Cage, you think of a lot of people, you know, if you're just online, you just think of the memes, or you think of, you know, crazy Nick Cage. But this is the thing that people have to realize. This guy is legitimately easily one of the best actors on the planet, and people don't understand that. You know, he's making all this direct-to-DVD, direct to pay for his taxes or whatever, but he always, every year, there's something that he makes that is, like, unique and is clearly fulfilling his artistic, you know, sensibilities or whatever, and he's really going for it. And I understand his style of acting in certain performances isn't for everyone, but I can guarantee you, if you're not a fan of Nick Cage and think he's a joke or whatever, I could point you in the direction of performance, and you would think he's legitimately great after seeing it or whatever. And I think this is what's great about Nick Cage, and what's great about casting him in a film like this, because it's one of these films where it's like, you know, it certainly has artistic intentions, but it also embraces the crazy and unhinged. And there is a few shots toward the end of this movie. There's one of Nick Cage staring at the camera with this creepy smile. I'll be honest, I think it's going to be etched into my brain forever. And honestly, I thought the ending, honestly, I have to give the film credit, because I thought the last few images, I thought it really left the film almost on an emotionally powerful note, which is something that you didn't really necessarily expect from a film of this type. But I thought that was interesting. I also, that sequence where, what's his name, Bill Duke is giving all the exposition to Nick Cage in the motorhome, I thought that was so funny. But it was almost, it felt like of a different era, because I haven't seen, when's the last time I saw Bill Duke on the screen or whatever, who knows. But I thought that was so fascinating. But I also, obviously, they're dealing with a lot of, you know, the filmmaker is clearly a fan of genre elements. He talked about how, like, he told Nick Cage to almost perform as like he was Jason Voorhees in the second half, which is really odd. But if you actually watch the film with that in mind, you could see it or whatever, for sure, or whatever. That's what I was alluding to, with a much more controlled sort of in the second half. When the revenge starts, you would think Nick Cage gets more unhinged, but it's actually the opposite, where he gets more controlled and sort of very, focused on his journey, leading him forward. But there's obviously clearly influences of genres. You know, some of the villains, they definitely remind me of some of the Cenobites from Hellraiser, you know, and stuff like this. There's all these these different genre elements, but essentially it comes together in this really crazy package that just really, I mean, like I said, the selling point, cinematography, like you could pick out any number of shots from this and there would be images that are just etched into your mind for like days on end afterwards. And the score, as we talked about, it's unfortunate that Johan Johansson, you know, left us too soon, because man, was this guy doing unbelievable work in recent years, even just from his collaborations with Denis Villeneuve. But I mean, he's done so much stuff, and here is more evidence of that. But honestly, you know, this film is really preaching to the choir for me, you know. I mean, of course I was gonna love this film. It's a film starring Nick Cage. It's in a genre element, but it's an art house sort of genre piece with crazy violence, crazy cinematography, crazy performances, but overall it's like an experience like nothing else, and you have to experience this. And of course I have to mention the king of all the memes now, Cheddar Goblin. I don't have to say anything more than that. People, you either know who Cheddar Goblin is already, even if you haven't seen the movie, or if you haven't, you need to watch this movie, or you can just go on YouTube and find the Cheddar Goblin sequence, and it's worth it just to see that.
Yeah, the Cheddar Goblin thing was actually, I don't know if we have any Adult Swim fans in the crowd, but he was actually, the man who directed those particular sequences was responsible for that insane short film that they put out at 4 o'clock in the morning called Too Many Cooks. If you don't know what Too Many Cooks is, just, you know, don't even look it up. Just go watch it and let me know what you think. I just want to touch on Nick Cage before we wrap up on this film, because like you said, he's one of the best actors on the planet. This is a guy, like, everyone shits on him and says that, oh, you know, he's just taking all these schlocky films and he's just hams it up for no reason and he's maniacal. I think this is an actor, regardless of what film it is, right, whether it's Adaptation, The Weatherman, or if it's Face Off, Con Air, anything, Wild at Heart. I mean, this is a guy who is actually two steps ahead of both the director and the audience. I mean, he really gets into his characters in such a bizarre way. And, you know, everyone is, of course, thinking, you know, not the bees, not the bees. And but that's fun. I mean, Nick Cage actually knew what that movie needed to be even remotely entertaining, and he went for it. And that's, and you know, like I said, we're all better off having him in our lives. And I know he's made some poor financial decisions, but hey, who the hell hasn't? And I know he's just come out with only like this crap alongside these direct-to-video John Travolta movies and all that. But this is a guy, you forget how good he actually is, and I maybe it's just that people are not aware that he is actually knows more about his character than we will ever comprehend, regardless of how many times we watch these movies. And he's making choices based on things that are not on the screen, not on the page, not in the director's head. This is just what he envisions his character to be, and it just comes out in such a bizarre way, and it switches from one scene to the next. But he does so fluidly that you don't question it. You know, Nick Cage is, I mean, going back to, what was that, Community episode with Abed trying to figure out, what is Nick Cage? What the hell is Nick Cage? Nick Cage is Nick Cage. You either love him or you don't, and if you don't, you're wrong.
Amen. I couldn't say it better myself, you know, and to quote Nicolas Cage himself, he is the California Klaus Kinski. And for those film buffs out there, you'll know what that means or whatever. And he's also talked about how he does his own California Kabuki, as he calls it, on the screen or whatever, and I think you'd understand. But I just wanted to quote Nick Cage, because this is the thing, like, if you watch interviews with him, you'd understand. I think, like, people think he's just some crazy guy. He's just like, he is literally an artist of the highest order who, as you said, puts much more thought than we do into any of these things. And I definitely understand that all of his performances won't always be for you, because he takes huge, massive risks. But as I saw recently, you know, go watch Vampire's Kiss on Amazon Prime, and then I think you'll understand the crazy of Nick Cage, and it couldn't be a better time of year to watch that. But I think with that said, we can sort of turn our attention to, you know, our next episode. And there's some debate, because Ryan is fortunate enough to be going away, so I'm debating whether I'm going to record a solo episode. We'll see how it turns out. I'm going to record it, and then we'll see how that goes, giving my thoughts on both Venom and A Star Is Born. But we'll be back eventually with a big loaded episode, where we'll be talking about Damien Chazelle's First Man, Bad Times at the El Royale, as well as the new Halloween. And then Ryan will share his thoughts on A Star Is Born.
And we will be picking up with All Quiet on the Western Front to continue our Best Picture series. It's just been like I said, everyone makes poor financial decisions, this guy included, and he wasn't able to rent movies on Amazon until fucking late in the week. But that's neither here nor there. We will continue that series eventually within the next couple weeks. Maybe not the next episode, but sometime soon. And I will also spare you my thoughts on Venom, and I will spare myself from having to sit through it. As always, we thank you for listening, and we'll see you next time.